The name of the album is Latinesque, but weirdly I can't stop thinking of like a late 1960s Disney movie with Fred McMurray and Michelle Lee. I don't But anyway, I like it. I'm not complaining. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Very nice to have you with us. And, well, it's Friday. We made it. Congratulations. We're here. And we have a wonderful panel. We have a lot to talk about, a lot of news, and we'll get to it in just a second. So let me remind you in the meantime that you can always be a part of our conversation. We certainly don't stop you. All you have to do is write to us. It's panel@wamc.org. We get a lot of letters. We get many more than we can actually read on the air, but we try to get a sampling of the comments and best pick those that are representative of the subjects coming into us. And also what helps us is if you, you know, you make sense in writing your letter. If the letter has a point and is has a beginning, a middle, and an end, well, you know, that's lovely. That's very nice, but, you know, be careful of what we wish for. Panel@wamc.org is the address, and we would love to hear from you this morning. Let me introduce our wonderful panel. We do have some terrific, we have terrific people, all are terrific people on the program this morning, and let me get to them. Well, first and foremost is WAMC's Alan Chartok. Good morning, sir. How are you?
As Popeye might say, I am fine.
I am.
I am, and I'm delighted that it's going to get warm soon. It's getting lighter, and it's going to happen.
Yeah, I was working at my desk yesterday afternoon, and I sort of just instinctively thought it was around, because it was starting to get dark, and I instinctively thought it was around 4:30, quarter to 5, and then I realized it was almost quarter to 6, and I thought, well, this is lovely. That's nice.
And then we're going to get double-crossed by daylight savings.
Next weekend.
You know what I mean.
Yep, not this weekend, but next weekend.
I don't like it one bit.
Now you lose an hour of sleep, but it's worth it because you get another, you know, you get to enjoy the day just a little bit longer. So that's all good.
Well, and on the other hand, when you're walking in the dark, I've been walking in the dark, and it's been lightening up now by 6 o'clock. And now it's going to be walking in the dark again. You see what I mean?
I do. But if you wait just like 20 minutes, you can not walk in the dark and still be earlier than normal. All right. It's math. We'll figure it out later. Judith Enck is with us, thank goodness. She is former EPA regional administrator, visiting professor at Bennington College, president of Beyond Plastics, and news source this week. Good morning, Judith Enck. How are you?
Good morning. Thanks, Joe. Nice to be with you.
Well, it's great to have you here. We'll get into your story a little bit later, but Judith was in the Times Union this week for telling her story of her interactions with the governor as a federal official, which made headlines and was fascinating. And we talked about you a lot this week, so it's nice to talk to you this morning.
Et tu, Brute?
That's right.
Aaron. And just a quick correction, my interactions were with the governor's staff, not with him.
That's
personally.
Correct. Yes. With the governor's office, I should say. Yes.
Yep.
Thank you.
Thanks.
For the clarification. Aaron Pasitti, thank you very much for being here. Aaron has job numbers to tell us about, so he's more than a little excited. Why do I know he's excited? Because he wrote me about it at about 10:30 yesterday morning. He was that excited. Like, hey, they're coming. Be ready. So, Siena College economics professor Aaron Pasitti, good morning. How are you? Go ahead. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm doing well. And good. It took a lot of restraint not to send you that email on Monday.
Well, I don't care when you send it. I'm just thrilled that you're excited to talk about it. It's I don't know. We'll get into it, but it's like relatively good news, right? I mean, it's not horrible.
It's the first bit of good news we've had in a while.
Okay, we'll go with that. Speaking of good news, David Soares is here. He is Albany County District Attorney. He is our dear friend. Good morning, David. How are you?
Hey, I'm good. Is it wrong that perhaps my favorite part of Friday is listening to Alan's first world problems? I mean, I just love it. The man is actually complaining about light.
Yeah, well, so, you know.
Yeah, you're not alone in that. I get an occasional letter mirroring that. So why don't you just sign your name and get it over with?
Well, just so everyone knows, the panel has already been active and interacting with each other via email and text. So they're ready. I believe our producer referred to them as a rowdy bunch this morning. So we're ready to go, and we're very excited. So here we go. We welcome you. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. And again, it's lovely to have you. So let us begin with the story coming out of last night, breaking both in the New York Times as well as the Wall Street Journal, this on Governor Cuomo. And the fact that the reporting of course, we know that there's basically two issues that the governor is having. One is the nursing homes report, and the other are the harassment and bullying claims. So when it comes to the nursing home report, the latest here from the New York Times, again, I believe the story was originally broken by the Wall Street Journal, who beat the Times by a few moments, but I'll read you from the Times report. Cuomo aides rewrote nursing home report to hide higher death toll. The intervention was the earliest action yet known in an effort by Governor Cuomo that concealed how many nursing home residents died in the pandemic. Top aides to the governor were alarmed. A report written by state health officials had just landed, and it included a count of how many nursing home residents in New York had died in the pandemic. The number, more than 9,000 by that point in June, was not public, and the governor's most senior aides wanted to keep it that way. They rewrote the report to take it out, according to interviews and documents reviewed by the New York Times. The extraordinary intervention, that from the Times, the extraordinary intervention, which came just as Mr. Cuomo was starting to write a book on his pandemic achievements, was the earliest act yet known in what critics have called a months-long effort by the governor and his aides to obscure the full scope of nursing home deaths. After the state attorney general revealed earlier this year that thousands of deaths of nursing home residents had been undercounted, Mr. Cuomo finally released the complete data, saying he had withheld it out of concern that the Trump administration might pursue a politically motivated inquiry into the state's handling of the outbreak in nursing homes. We know that, according to this report anyway, that the aides actually began concealing the numbers months earlier, and they were battling their own top health officials. So the discussions were going on well before we thought they were, but also at the highest levels and against the wishes of those in the health department, who, by the way, were leaving the health department at a good clip because of these fights. There was one more point I wanted to make,
about the woman.
Well, I know. I mean, that's a separate. But the one other point I wanted to make about the nursing home report was about actually who did it, and we know that it was
Melissa DeRosa.
Melissa DeRosa, and the second name is
The woman who does financial services, Linda Lacewell.
There you go.
And then it said Jim Malatris was looking at early drafts, but did not go along with the final deception in the report. And he's now he's the chancellor of SUNY.
Right. So
I think the story really points fingers at DeRosa and Linda Lacewell and the climate in the governor's office that would allow them to do this.
Which was basically, we don't want these numbers getting out, so we're going to do what we have to do to keep these numbers from getting out. Okay, Alan, what do we make of it?
I say back to Judith. She's doing a terrific job. I'm very interested in what she has to say here. Judith, continue.
Well, all I did was read the New York Times article.
And remember the names, which was more than I could do.
You and everybody else. Right. Go ahead. And yeah, by the way, the guest on the Capital Connection this week is Jesse McKinley, the Albany guy for the New York Times. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, that'll be interesting. You know, this is deeply troubling. This is about people's grandparents and parents and aunts and uncles dying. And the last thing you want to do is cover up the reality. I certainly think this will be of interest to the federal investigators. U.S. Department of Justice has opened an investigation into the nursing home undercounting in August. I think the other striking thing is Health Commissioner Howard Zucker, who maintains his job, oddly. He must have known this was going on. It's his agency. And he still went out in July and did a news conference releasing the lower numbers of 6,400 and blaming the high deaths in nursing homes on nursing home staffers who unknowingly brought the virus into the nursing homes. So, you know, often it's said the cover-up is worse than the crime. I think in this instance, the cover-up is terrible. And I don't know if this is a crime or just tremendous incompetence, but both are a problem. And the final thing I'll say is we don't really know if they were trying to block important, accurate numbers from getting out because the governor had a book coming out, as everyone recalls.
I was going to ask you about that. About the motivation, because certainly in this Times report, which in this case is by Denny Hakim, is interesting because it does lead you to believe that there was this, the governor kind of muses out loud that, you know, maybe this would be a great book. Apparently, a deal is in the works to do a book and about the successes that the administration has had. And while all of this is happening, these numbers are being, there's this great fight going on to keep these numbers quiet.
Yeah, and I always thought it was weird when I first heard that the governor was writing a book on his handling of COVID, in which case I think he did many things right. I mean, I think one thing he did very wrong was blocking de Blasio from requiring a stay-at-home order earlier than Cuomo wanted. Cuomo eventually came around, but experts have said if they did the stay-at-home order in New York City, it would have saved, I think, 17,000 lives. There's that little thing. But other than that, and the nursing home terrible situation, I think, you know, Cuomo was widely lauded for doing good work on the pandemic. But I thought it was so bizarre that he put a book out when the final story was not written on the pandemic. I mean, it is still out of control and there's a lot he can't control. And yet he decided to take a victory round, a victory lap with the book, which at the time just struck me as really risky.
Really weird. And we talked about it at the time because while he was talking about the book and saying that it was of the New York success story and us being New York tough, we all knew he was the one that was telling us every day that it's summer and wait till the fall and this thing isn't over and we haven't seen the last of it. So that makes it even odder. David Soares, I'd love your thoughts on this.
You know, so first of all, there's the obvious number of people who've lost their lives, right? And so if you're a family member of someone who was in a nursing home, you've got to wonder, How are they feeling in this moment right now, knowing that, you know, they've lost time with their loved ones because of decisions that were being made and decisions that, at least on the surface right now, appear to be motivated by this desire to continue to grow your national profile through books and also other endeavors. So, you know, I have to wonder how those individuals are feeling this morning, understanding that over the last year that they've been lied to as to the reasons why they're not going to be spending any time with their loved ones in nursing homes. That's point number one. Point number two is that right now, you know, it's almost like palace intrigue where we're looking at this and saying, well, the real number was this, the real number was that. For me, it's an entirely different analysis. And the analysis is this. Were those numbers being used to obtain any kind of benefit? In other words, what was the numbers being used for as far as the nursing home? Did they have an obligation to report out those numbers? Those numbers translate into something? that the nursing homes were going to be in receipt of. And where I'm going here is there a possibility here that there's exposure for falsifying information and then turning that falsified information over to a federal authority under the penalty of perjury, right? So there's criminal liability that really hangs out there. And as we continue to probe these stories, you know, the individuals who are responsible for acting on behalf of the second floor, specifically DeRozier and Lacewell, I'm hoping that they're already in discussions with counsel, because if true, these are individuals who could be subjected to criminal liability down the road. And this is the story that I think we have to continue to watch out for as we move from week to week and more of these facts become available to us.
Well, what about the state violation, David? You spoke about the potential for federal, but obviously you're in charge of Albany. That's your catchment area. Are you looking at any potential criminal charges, not only against the governor, but his subordinates?
And please make the answer less than 15 seconds. Go ahead.
Well, there's always the possibility. You're always open to the possibility that it exists, and when it's uncovered, then those decisions will be made later on down the line. But it's not just Albany. It's a number of different jurisdictions throughout the state.
All right, you did it in 15 seconds. Good for you. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we will continue. We'll have Aaron Pasitti check in as well, and we'll continue our conversation. We have a number of letters as well. We welcome yours, panel at WAMC.org. A dear listener and friend said, you heard Fred McMurray and Michelle Lee. I'm older, so I heard Lucy and Desi at the end of their Cuban Pete routine. But again, it's all from an album that is called Latin-esque. It's Esquivel, I believe is how that's pronounced. Esquivel is the group. But great stuff. Good morning, everybody. Welcome. Oh, a reminder, we have all of our music posted on our website. It's WAMC.org/roundtable, and there's a playlist posted there that'll tell you what is playing at any given time, and you can see there if you want to make notes and jot it down. We've been talking about the nursing home situation in New York State, the governor's handling of it, and the story that broke last night about the suppression of numbers and the rewriting of a report. Aaron Pasitti, you're up.
I don't have much to add, but I do want to build on something David said. I think David said it. It's tough to figure out what the motivation for this was, in that it's, you know, it wasn't trying to understate the number of deaths, is my understanding. It was just, you know, reallocating them to different, you know, different locations. So since all of this happened, you know, the argument was that this was, you know, to preemptively prevent an investigation or whatever. But in seeing the article this morning, it just seems to be self-serving, in that he was moving these numbers to make himself look better. And whether that was to, you know, boost copies of his book whenever it came out, or just kind of, you know, trying to, in a very egotistical manner, steal the spotlight from Trump, that's anybody's guess. But it is very curious, and it's really tough to put a finger on why, you know, what the motivation is. And I don't know if that's if it is a personal issue. Where Cuomo was trying to boost his, you know, social and political capital, you know, a very dangerous move on his part, not only in terms of his own interests, but also in terms of public health.
Alan, would you like to guess at motive?
Yeah, I would. I was going to open my app anyway, and here it is. It all goes to character. It all goes to Cuomo's character. He's an over-controller. And I do believe that's what it's about. You know, he sees a phenomena, and rather than just leave it alone, he says, well, I better play with this myself. I think I can, therefore I should. I think it is Andrew's character from the very beginning. That's what this has all been about, that he gets himself into trouble because he goes and says things that he shouldn't say, and he does things that he shouldn't do. It's that simple. My solution to this is just shut up. And by the way, we just got a letter about David Soares. Somebody wants to know if David Soares has any thoughts about running for governor.
David? I think we killed David. David? David?
No, you didn't kill me at this point. I'm just running. Hey, I'm at this point, my only goal is to run away from Sarah LaDuc, who's the producer here, who I seem to upset every Friday.
What'd you do?
No, he pokes the hornet's nest. I'm
on the music?
Not everything, but yeah. But it's fine.
We love him.
I want to help get David out of this. So I think Alan is right, but it's also about how elected officials choose to govern. And you cannot lie to the public. Full stop. And this did not happen, in isolation. Not only did the Cuomo administration lie about the number of people that died in nursing homes, but also they included a provision in the state budget last year that provided liability immunity for the owners and operators of nursing homes.
Yeah.
Now, one could argue that this was an emergency pandemic situation. And so what you do is during one of your nationally televised news conferences, you say, our nursing homes are in crisis. I am providing this liability waiver for the following reasons. And I'm putting in backstops to make sure that care is not compromised. But instead, this was slipped into a budget bill. Many lawmakers said they didn't know it was in there. And now Assemblymember Kim, who was on the receiving end of a difficult phone call from the governor, is working to change that liability waiver. So there's just a pattern here that is troubling. I think it does have some connection to the governor trying to have a very positive national image with his book, but it also goes straight to the heart of how he chooses to govern.
So while we are at this subject, Judith, for those who may not be aware, could you briefly describe your brush with that culture and the story that has been published and picked up throughout, the state and even the country? I heard your name on national news mentioned, because you told the story of while working at the EPA and dealing with the governor's office and the bullying tactics that are used.
Sure, why not? So on a number of high-profile issues where the EPA and the Cuomo administration had a difference in policy, the interaction with the Cuomo staff was extremely difficult. And the Times Union story from last Sunday in particular profiles a situation where EPA was my office, Region 2 EPA, filled with wonderful career staff. They wrote public comment on the state's environmental impact statement related to hydrofracking. You know, very contentious, high-profile issue. And at the time, the governor had not yet staked out his position on hydrofracking, which eventually he opposed. Thank you very much. But it was a couple years before he got to that position. And so many months before he staked out his public position, I did what is an ordinary thing at EPA. We submitted comments on the Department of Environmental Conservation Environmental Impact Statement. We flagged a number of serious concerns, for instance, impact on the New York City watershed. The state wanted to allow fracking waste to be spread on public roads as a de-icing agent. We thought that was a really bad idea. So we put that in our comments and explained why. The comments were due at midnight and we got them in and then like around 9 p.m. It was a big, big effort getting these comments in. And then about 10 minutes to midnight, I'm already asleep, and the phone rings. So you know that dynamic, right? Your phone rings in the middle of the night. You think there's some kind of family emergency,
right,
which actually did happen in my family, tragically. So, you know, my heart is racing. I get to the phone, and there is the voice of a gentleman named Howard Glazer, who is a top Cuomo official, screaming at me, cursing at me. And you should know, I don't like the F word. And I heard it a lot because he wanted me to withdraw the EPA comments that had been submitted. And I told him I was not going to do that. He said he would destroy me in the press the next morning. I was jeopardizing the Obama administration relationship with the Cuomo administration. When I kept saying I was not going to withdraw the comments, he insisted that I call the EPA administrator in Washington and tell her that I'm destroying the Obama-Cuomo relationship. I told him I'm not going to wake her up and call her up. He told me he had already called the White House to complain about the comments. So at that point, even though the call was very abusive, my goal was to keep him on the phone until after midnight when the public comment period closed. So he was just very aggressive, very nasty. I had never talked to the guy before. I knew who he was. So we got past midnight. The public comment period closed. He asked me again if I would withdraw the comments. I said no. I ended the call. So, you know, I'll say I was shaken by the call. I had a hard time sleeping that night. I wasn't worried that he was going to destroy my reputation in the press, because I'm happy to defend my environmental record in the press. But it was, you know, it's one of those late night calls. And why I think this is different than the scores of other people who've gotten really nasty calls from the governor's office is I was a federal official at the time, and he was asking me to withdraw a federal document from the docket. And that just seemed fundamentally wrong. So I wouldn't do that.
Did you think that the governor put him up to it?
I don't know. I did get the feeling that he was not in the room alone when he was calling me. And the real tell was when he kept calling me Judy. That was my 1980s name. It's Judith now.
That was so 1980s. Can I say one of the things that I thought, besides the fact that, to me, one of the things that was maybe lost in the story was that we hear about this intimidation within state government, that the fact that that was happening to the Obama administration, and as you stated just a moment ago, Judith, that they were telling, you know, they didn't want this to interfere with other negotiations that they were having with the Obama administration. And so the threatening tone of that. But the other thing that you tell in that story, which I found fascinating, is the fact that people who are friends of yours, people that you know very well, call you up, like mm-hmm. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who is there to check in and seeing how you're doing. Now, you don't know how they would ever know that that call took place, because you haven't told anybody. And what they're ultimately asking you is, are you going to do anything about it?
Right.
And so the army is dispatched, right? I mean, this gets back to Allen's, does the governor know? Well, somebody is calling those shots to deploy the army to check on Judith, right?
Yep. Yeah, those were really annoying calls. And I just said, they wanted to know what I was going to do. I mean, my guess is maybe Glazer shared what he did and someone said, oh man, you really screwed up on this one. You're not going to succeed in destroying her in New York or her reputation. You got to go try to fix this. So I was disappointed to get the call from Robert F. Kennedy and another person under the guise of, oh, I heard you had a really difficult midnight phone call. Like, I'm a damsel in distress. I can handle it myself. So it didn't feel like it came from a place of concern. It came from a place of they wanted to know what I was going to do about it.
The other thing,
I'm going to tell you something right now. I know of Howard Glaser very well, and I'm telling you now, he didn't make that call on his own. You're very kind to say maybe he did, but he didn't, in my opinion.
I would also like to point out, you know, of people as these stories are coming out and people say, well, you know, why didn't you do anything about it then? Well, you contacted an attorney, a private attorney that day, right, Judith? I mean, you called up. Concerning enough to you that you wanted to consult a private attorney about Glaser's threats.
Yeah, that was a minor mistake in the otherwise very good, accurate story by the Times Union. I consulted my EPA attorney,
okay,
not a private attorney.
Okay.
Well,
that saves you money.
Yeah, of course.
That saves you a few bucks. Attorney. That's good. All right.
I mostly wanted to make sure, you know, that our document was protected. And I wanted to know, is it illegal to threaten a federal official over, you know, something that's official business? He came back and said, well, the first thing he said is write everything down. So when the call was taking place, I actually grabbed like a bunch of Christmas card envelopes and wrote notes and then brought them to work the next morning. And he said, before I talk to you, write it all down. So I have 2 pages of notes. I'm happy to share with anyone who wants to read them. They're just a delightful read.
That's why the F word was on my envelope from your Christmas card this year. I was wondering why that was the case.
Stole my joke.
I hate the F word.
I wonder why you're using such abusive language on a lovely Christmas card. Go ahead.
So the lawyer told me, don't talk to me yet, write everything down. So I wrote everything down, and then he did some research, and he said, what happened to you would have been illegal in Pennsylvania, but not in New York. There's no law that prevents someone in government bullying someone else in government to get an official document withdrawn. I wanted to protect that document. And so we got our comments in, and then many, many months later, the governor came out against hydrofracking. I do want to say this was a dramatic late night call, but you know, I had lots of other dealings with the governor's office where wherever we had a policy dispute, whether it was Hoosick Falls or the governor wanted to take $700 million in clean water EPA funds and use it on Tappan Zee Bridge or Mario Cuomo Bridge reconstruction, we said no to that. I mean, it was just like, it was a psychodrama, and it was easier. Now, I'm going to get a lot of grief on this, but my EPA region was New York, New Jersey, Puerto Rico, U.S. Virgin Islands. It was easier for me to deal with the Chris Christie administration than it was with the Cuomo administration. I had lots of disagreements with the Chris Christie administration. A few of them can be yellers, but not in the league of the Cuomo yellers. But the thing with the Christie administration, you disagreed with something and you compartmentalized, and then you went on to work together on other important issues.
You just couldn't get across the bridge.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not holding them up as a paradigm of good government. But the day-to-day interaction was much easier with New Jersey than New York.
All right, let's take a break. Thank you for sharing that. I think it's an interesting story as we try to flesh all this out and to understand what we're dealing with. We'll take a break. We welcome your letters, and we will continue. Judith Enck is here. Alan Chartok, Aaron Pasitti, and David Soares, they make up the panel. We'll be right back after this. At the risk of getting in trouble and not putting you in an awkward position at all, David Soares, but I mean, do you understand or have similar stories in dealing with the administration in your role as district attorney of the County of Albany?
I don't think they make it a point to call prosecutors, whether that be me or any others throughout the state, and engage in the kind of yelling that other people probably experience. And to be quite frank with you, the last time that I had any contact with the administration where there were efforts to exert pressure. That was on a soccer field when they were attempting to convince me to arrest protesters in front of the Capitol, which I declined. But Judith's story is a similar story that so many others have experienced, and I feel for her. But I also think, to put a fine note on it, that the vast majority of people who work in government go to that job every day with the same intentions that the artist formerly known as Judy goes to the office. You see fine examples of public servants who either resign in protest or take the same stance that Judith took. I think that if prosecutors at the Department of Justice several months ago didn't threaten to resign en masse over efforts to challenge and otherwise interfere with the electoral process, if they hadn't done that, we'd be having an entirely different conversation today. But I think that, you know, what we're seeing in New York and what we've just seen in D.C., there are two things in common. A, both executives are from Queens. I just want to put that out there. And two, I think we're seeing what happens when government is governed by those who have other interests other than the people that they serve.
And while we are on this, for this one little moment, David, I want to once again congratulate you for having the guts to do what you did when a bunch of academics were standing on a lawn and apparently the governor's people wanted them arrested and you wouldn't do it. Good for you, David.
I appreciate that. The one thing that I want to get back to that Judith said that I'm so happy she mentioned it today, because this leapt off the page for me as well. Is when she too noticed the liability protection language in the budget specifically for the nursing home. That came out of left field. And what I took notice of is when Mitch McConnell had attempted to provide liability protection for businesses as a way mm-hmm. for him to sign mm-hmm. on to the previous relief package, people flipped out and were attacking Mitch McConnell. But we didn't see that reaction here in New York when that language was there, too. And somehow I think that people will now begin to look at that a little differently than they did in the past.
And while we're on the subject, if I may, Joe, for one second, it takes away from the thrust of the story. But we are reading in the papers this morning, the major papers, about Elaine Chao, McConnell's wife, who is apparently a very wealthy woman from a very wealthy family with very important connections. She's now being called into question for a conflict of interest, too.
I was interested in that story, and we can talk more about it after the break because we only have about 2 or 3 minutes before. But I was fascinated by that because, and Judith, I bring up, I ask you this question because I think you were one of the people that brought it up. I mean, we knew this at the time, right? There were great concerns about her conflicts of interest upon her confirmation. Am I correct on that?
Oh, yeah, because of her family business. We didn't know she would use federal staff to deliver holiday gifts, though. There's a Inspector General report that is just very damning that deals with how she promoted her family's private business and then all sorts of other inappropriate behavior for a federal official.
And while we're on the subject, Joe, if I may very quickly ask you yet another question, and that is, you're a superb regional administrator. Many of us thought you should be named to the cabinet in the head EPA position now. Do you think your past troublemaker, in quotes, position may have influenced the fact that you weren't asked for that job?
No, I don't think so. I didn't want to do the job. I mean, I was invited to apply for some positions. And I know, Alan, you've phrased this a few times. I really like my little life.
You'd rather be on WAMC.
Yeah, and teaching is really enjoyable. And
right.
what really is the factor for me is when I'm working intently on an issue, and in this case, I've decided to work on plastic pollution, am I more effective on the inside or on the outside? And on this issue, I think I'm more effective on the outside. But yeah, I mean, my reputation is that I push really hard, particularly when it comes to public health protection. But I didn't really pursue a federal position.
I think you talked about that on a show about, you know, you sort of put your name in the running and you were given that opportunity and declined. So
yeah, I was asked to submit a resume. I submitted a resume and then I did nothing about it.
Yeah.
And I really like all the people that Biden has chosen. He's got great people working on environmental issues.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have a lot of letters on Governor Cuomo and what we've been discussing about Judith's situation. So a lot going on there. We will wrap those up, and then we'll move on to other topics. Yes, Aaron, we will talk jobless numbers. I promise you all of that and much more coming up after this news with Ray Graff. Paul writes about the music sounds exactly like the music used by Ernie Kovacs in the early 60s. It seemed to start inanimate objects move to the rhythms. You can watch those videos, says Paul at Albany.
And you can, and I knew Ernie Kovacs because my twin brother Luke.
I can't hear you, Alan.
Oh, yeah. And I knew Ernie Kovacs because my twin brother and I were invited to be part of a show that he was doing one day, and he played magic tricks by putting a sheet over each of us and then saying, see, I can move him from one side of the room to the other.
So
I just want you to know he was one brilliant fella. Can I just read one letter, Joe? It's,
yep.
Hooray for Judith. I just wanted to applaud Judith and thank her for sticking up for what is right. 3 exclamation marks. I love the show and always enjoy your perspectives. Parentheses. Especially Judith. Keep up the good work. From Rebecca.
Thank you, Rebecca.
All right. Let's see. We got another letter from David who writes, and not our David. Judith's, this is about Judith's story. I had trouble integrating the leadership shown by Governor Cuomo during the early pandemic with the recent attacks on his character. Then I heard Judith's story, and now I get it. So thank you, Judith. Well, that is interesting. I agree. I think that context is important. Okay, let's see. We have a lot of letters here. We'll go to these quick, and then I want to get to the jobs numbers. Rachel says, great panel as always. I have to disagree with Judith, who I generally agree with. I believe that the last 4 years have proven definitively that politicians absolutely can lie to the public as long as they do it shamelessly and unapologetically. I do not condone Cuomo's behavior, but I think the more unrepentant he remains, the more likely he is to remain in office. That is the political landscape. I'm not sure you would disagree with that, right, Judith?
Oh, yeah. I don't think he's going to resign.
Let's see. We go to Rob, who says, honestly, I agree with Aaron. There's no there in there. I live in Massachusetts, but I look forward to Governor Cuomo's daily press releases all through the summer and into the fall. He was the only person who gave me solace, and I feel badly for what's happening because there is no there. Well, there's something there, right? I mean, that we can say of whether it's dire enough for him to resign or to be impeached or for him not to run again, but there is something there, right, Alan?
Well, he is not going to be impeached. He is not going to resign. And I believe, in contradistinction, my favorite words, so many others, that he is going to run again.
I think that was the name of the music we just heard. Contradistinction.
By the way, while we're talking music, I want to put in a plug for Spike Jones. That's something else we should do. I wonder if anybody even remembers him.
Oh, I remember Spike Jones.
Yeah.
Just a point of correction. Can I just take that on for a second?
About Spike Jones?
I do not think that Aaron said that there's no there. I think we were talking about motive, and that's the reason why Aaron made that comment.
Yeah, about what the motive is.
But to suggest that there's no there when you have
thousands of New Yorkers who left their parents and family members in a nursing home, and they're not going to be able to visit with them, you know, this year, or haven't spoken to them because they're now dead, to suggest that there's no there is super absurd. I mean, I'm really glad that you were comforted by the afternoon briefings, but to just cast aside the feelings that people are waking up with every day, knowing now finally learning the truth, is just absolutely absurd.
Rob?
Yeah, thank you, David. I just real quickly, like, there is a there. It's why is that specific there?
Wow, we're getting very...
I want to know who's there. How are you spelling there?
T-H-E-R-E.
I got it. Bad
yeah.
Joke.
Okay. Edie says, follow the money. How much in donations does the governor get from nursing homes, which perhaps he was trying to protect? Question mark. We go to Warren, who says...
That's a really important question, not only for the governor, but for everybody else in New York politics. You know, nursing homes have been scandalized since the... Stanley Steingut was the speaker. Who? This has been a real bad influence on our politics. I think it's an important question.
Warren writes, there are different reimbursements for a death in hospital due to COVID and one in a nursing home due to COVID. We go to this letter from Jim. Question for David Soares. We the people, why can't we sue the politicians and their minions directly? Why do we need to wait for another government agency to take our place? David.
Standing, and that's the rules that have been authored. I mean, suppose you could perhaps find a politician that's willing to rewrite the intricacies of what standing is, and you could perhaps bring a lawsuit. But that's just the way that the things are. But, you know, it's a very good question, because right now you do have recourse, and that recourse is what you do when you go and vote. And the reason why we continue to have the representation that we have, and I'm not just talking about locally, I'm talking about Ron Johnson, who we'll get to at some point.
Yeah.
I'm talking about the Ted Cruz's of the world. I'm talking about the Willie Gohmerts, you know, of the world. The reason we have representatives like this in government is because people elect them. And then those same people continue to overlook, you know, their tremendous flaws. So you do have recourse.
All right, real quickly, two more letters, one from Dan. Can you give a quick recap of why Cuomo sent COVID patients back into nursing homes in the first place? It seems that is a central point in the story that is never brought up in the reporting. I think we've talked about it fairly extensively in past shows. But Judith, real quick, do you want to address that?
Yeah, I think the governor said he was following CDC guidelines, and there was probably real practical concerns that when people who were COVID positive still were leaving hospitals, going back into nursing homes, obviously looked like a not a smart move, but they, you know, they probably thought they had no other choice. I think they did have other choices, but their defense was this is what CDC told them to do.
Finally, I want to go to this letter from Doreen, who writes, I can't get past these two issues when it comes to alleged harassment of Ms. Bennett by Governor Cuomo. How did Cuomo know about her past sexual abuse? Why the heck did Ms. Bennett talk to him about this in the first place? You can't have it both ways. Also, who is paying for her high power attorney, the same attorney that represented Christine Blasey Ford?
Oh, my goodness.
So we finally get one of those letters that I believe are written by an ally of the second floor. And thank you very much for sending that in. You know, but I will say this, you know, no one disclosed her status as a victim other than the governor in his half-hearted apology. That's one of the things that I took offense to listening and reading that apology last week, is that we would not have known that, but for that particular item coming out in the apology, and that's really offensive. But that letter there, that letter's from an ally.
And you don't know that. David, to be fair, you don't know that. Look, there are people who are writing me every day. There are 20 people who write me every so often and say, Governor's a great man. He's this, he's that, he's that. And I also get a few on the other side. But
you're right, Alan. I don't know that. But, you know, it's always what happens when someone amounts the courage to come forward with something that is so deeply personal. It's the pig pile. It's who we blame the victim.
Blame the victim, exactly. Yeah. Judith.
And I just want to point out, it doesn't matter who's paying for her lawyer. I'm just glad she has a lawyer. And I don't know who revealed what. I just think it's really important to recognize that Charlotte Bennett was 25 years old. She worked for Governor Cuomo, age 63. She revealed to him in some manner that she was the victim of sexual assault. And then, according to Ms. Bennett, she was sexually harassed by her boss. That's what we should really focus on. And David is right. The governor publicly revealed she was a victim of sexual assault. In sexual harassment cases, retribution is often an issue. And when Lindsay Boylan, the governor's deputy secretary for economic development, started, you know, in phases to reveal problems she had with the governor, someone leaked her personnel file the next day. So that is retribution. I think both of these women are incredibly brave, and I just have zero tolerance for attacking their integrity, given everything they've gone through.
I also think in the Bennett case, it's so important, and I see this being lost. I mean, we've discussed it here, but and many places have mentioned it, but I do think it gets lost sometimes. She immediately after that encounter, she reported it. She reported mm-hmm. it. She did exactly what she was supposed to do. She reported it. She was moved to another department, and then several weeks later, finally left the job because she was so uncomfortable and so bothered by what had transpired on that date. So to say, you know, why we got a couple of letters earlier in the week that were, you know, why didn't she stand up to him then? Why didn't she, you know, put her hands on her hips and say, I'm not going to answer that and storm out. I would question as to whether anyone would do that to their boss, much less the governor of a state. But, you know, I think the fact that she did everything by, quote unquote, the book, and still what happened is that she ended up leaving the state says a lot about what happened and how, for want of a better term, traumatizing it was.
And she's
Joe, we're getting
25.
A ton of.
Yeah,
she's 25 years old.
Male or female, 25 is young. And and if you are, you know, if you are in a situation, whatever gender, you are in a situation like that, it is difficult. Alan.
I was just going to say we're getting a ton of mail. I'm reading the mail as we go on both sides of this, obviously. It is really interesting that there are so many people who are taking the governor's side, even though I have some problems with that.
Well, if the governor's side is that he shouldn't resign or that he should stay in office, that's one thing. If the governor's side is that he's right in doing what he did, then that is more problematic, is it not?
Yeah, I see your point.
Yeah, but this is, for people who work on sexual harassment, this is not surprising.
Right.
Women who come forward often have their integrity and their motivation attacked. And that's why many women and men, in some instances, do not come forward.
Can I ask a question, Judith? And I apologize for putting you on the spot to ask this question. One of the things that I have found disturbing is that many of the letters that we have gotten, that the especially... and we had a couple of them already this morning. The especially bruising letters in regards to the victim come from women.
Yeah, I don't know why that is. Maybe they've had some experiences in their life and they handled it differently. but that is certainly surprising.
All right.
We experience this every day, as you're going through voir dire in a sexual assault case. You know, these are the attitudes that are reflected from prospective jurists. And that's the reason why we have voir dire, to sort of flesh that out.
Right.
And you know, it's this attitude towards women that prevents so many women from coming forward and reporting the most heinous crimes.
Well,
what I do think is a little different, though, is the young women who have zero tolerance for this behavior and who are speaking out, including if you look at the New York State Legislature and which members are kind of standing on the sidelines on this and which ones are being very proactive. It's the younger women elected officials. I think there might be some generational issues here.
Yes.
And thankfully, I think attitudes are changing. But I'm really disturbed by this one letter questioning Charlotte Bennett's motives and how she got an attorney. That we're better than that.
All right. I want to change the subject, and not because, not for any other reason other than I want to get to other things. And I promised Aaron on Monday when he asked me that about the jobs report. So what we know is that it could be a sign of hope. After a winter hibernation, the employers have reported that they have added 379,000 jobs. Hiring picked up steam in February as a winter wave of coronavirus infections eased and consumers spent more freely. The employers added those jobs in February while the unemployment rate dipped to 6.2%. Aaron Pasitti, take it away.
So, like I said this morning, this is good news, generally, that things are moving in the right direction. The labor market is starting to add jobs, and it's a good sign that there might be, you know, that the labor market's starting to thaw and that employers are starting to add jobs back. So that's the good news. But there's, you know, like everything I say, some bad news behind that. We're still off 10 million jobs, approximately, from the start of the pandemic. So even at this rate of very accelerated hiring, we're still looking at another 3 years before we get back to where we were when the pandemic started. And it's probably unlikely that, at least through the spring, that this rate of job creation will continue. Over 90% of those 379,000 jobs were added in the leisure and hospitality sector. That's the low-hanging fruit. Those are the jobs that were the first to disappear, and they'll probably be the first to come back. You know, face-to-face service jobs. The bad news is that we're not seeing those levels of job creation in other industries that have been affected by the pandemic. So leisure and hospitality can't lead this recovery. And those also tend to be the low quality jobs that, you know, pay minimum wage or low wage, or that tend to be minimum wage or low wage jobs. So, you know, there needs to be cautious optimism with this. So all of that said, the this could be bad news politically as well, in that with the American Rescue Plan coming before Congress, that Republicans can latch onto this and say, see, the economy's recovering. We don't need to be spending $1.9 trillion because we're, you know, pretty much out of the woods. That's so far from true and conveys a real deep misunderstanding of what's happening in the economy. Biden's stimulus bill, and I just said it, the plan that's before the Senate now is not really a stimulus. It's a relief plan. And the point of that is to provide income assistance to households and financial support to businesses to help them weather this storm, to help them, you know, make ends meet so that when the economy does recover, those jobs and those businesses are not lost forever. So it's really important that, you know, Congress, and it looks like this is going to happen, pass the relief bill. But, you know, that's if those jobs aren't coming back to, you know, 2024, we're going to need multiple relief bills. So the good news is that the economy added, almost 75% more jobs than economists were expecting. The bad news is that, you know, we need more of this. This needs to continue. And hopefully with the increased pace of vaccinations and continued vigilance in terms of mask wearing and social distancing, that this could be a light at the end of the tunnel.
Well, that is good news. So how does this then go to the story about where we are in the Senate debate on the relief bill? And they voted to open debate on the bill. Democrats are moving forward without GOP support. There have been these 11th hour negotiations. So we're still a long way from knowing what's in this thing, right, Aaron?
The core of the bill was read last night.
Oh, yes. We know. It was read out loud.
We should know what's in it.
Chapter and verse, we know.
Yeah, no, I think any senator that proposes that should be required to read it themselves.
Yes.
As opposed to passing that on to others. Anyways,
I also thought it would be interesting of that issue. Person who has the job of raising upping and lowering the flags throughout the day on the Capitol, that they could just have them like mumble through it as they're doing that. You know, just kill two birds with one stone. Go ahead, Aaron. I apologize.
The core of this bill, the $400 unemployment insurance subsidy, the $1,400 direct checks to households, money for vaccine distribution, the emergency paid leave, the rent and the rental assistance and eviction moratoriums, the small business grants, aid to state and local governments. That core has been there from the beginning, and that's the big goal of the plan is income assistance to households and income assistance to businesses. That hasn't changed. So most of what Ron Johnson and other Republican senators are saying is that, well, there's going to be all this other, you know, pork added to the bill. And yeah, they're right. But that's around the edges. That's not anything that gets to the core of the plan. The only major difference between the House bill and the Senate bill is the getting the $15 minimum wage legislation out of the Senate bill. So it doesn't look like that's going through, which is unfortunate. But as a whole, the core is pretty much set and it's necessary. A lot of these assistance programs will, once they're passed, continue through September. And what's interesting to me is the fact that, I'm not sure what Republicans are opposed to. I've not heard, you know, there's this, you know, McConnell's trying to propose a unified Republican opposition to this bill, but it's tough to figure out what the opposition, where the opposition is directed. Is it because, you know, the deficit, it's going to increase the deficit? Is it because they think the economy is okay?
Is it because
Biden they think households are on firmer financial footing? Yeah, no, I know. That's right. This is going back to McConnell saying our goal is to make Obama a one-term president. So
right. It's
really important to understand that Republicans they're the ones who are not being bipartisan. This is a relatively small relief bill, all things considered, when if you take a cold, hard look at what the economy needs to weather this storm, this is relatively low. And I'm not the only person saying this. Jerome Powell, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, said this the past week, is that we need more the risk is doing too little, not too much, and Republicans can't even mount a unified vision of why they're opposed to it and presenting something else. All they say is, well, it needs to be smaller. And it's just so, I mean, it's, they're going back to the bread and butter of what works for them, and that is just say no to anything that could give Democrats some political momentum.
You're absolutely right in that analysis.
We have about 15 seconds. Do you want to wait till after the break?
Sure.
In other words, please, will you wait till after the break? All right. We'll be right back after this and continue. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Nice to have you with us. It's our last call here on this Friday morning with our wonderful panel, Alan Chartok, Judith Eng, Aaron Pasitti, and David Soares. Hey, Judith, where did all the butterflies go to?
Wow.
There's a story in the Washington Post this morning about how butterflies are vanishing out west. The scientists are saying that climate change is to blame, but one scientist says in this article that the rate of decline is calamitous. Given that I think most of us are pro-butterfly and just that it is a good example as to what is happening and how climate change affects things that, you know, we take for granted, like butterflies, I thought it was a very interesting story in regards to our climate and environment.
Yeah, thank you for raising it. It reminds me a little bit about the decline in pollinators.
Right.
So scientists are pointing to climate change impacts last year, tied for the second hottest year on record. So we think about sea level rise and more intense hurricanes and heat death. But we are really starting a giant science experiment. And I'm increasingly concerned that we're running out of time to reverse things like this. Carbon emissions that and methane emissions from fracking that go into the atmosphere today last for decades. So on the butterfly issue, climate change is a concern. It can also be an issue of overuse of pesticides and overdevelopment that takes away habitat.
But do we know what's true? I mean, the Chartoks sit on their front porch and watch a lot of butterflies and a lot of bees.
Well, this is out west.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So, but when we first heard about the bees and the rest of it, that distinction was not made.
The bee population is down worldwide. That has been documented. Yes. And lots of farmers are worried about it.
And it's the type of bees, right? It's the pollinators.
Yeah, the pollinators. And so, you know, you're still going to see bees, you're still going to see butterflies. But what these biological studies are doing is they're literally counting in looking at trends.
Just asking.
Yeah, I'm glad you have bees and butterflies. Imagine a world without them.
Well, that's it. You know, we said this a long time ago. I remember wondering, like, as I grew up with lightning bugs, fireflies, and
yes.
Well, you don't see them as much as you used to, and that's another thing that is.
We've got them too.
Yeah. My favorite. This is a tangent, and I will label it as such. But when growing up, one of my favorite articles ever was in the New York Times. There used to be a science column in the New York Times where people would have a question and answer. And this person who lived in Staten Island with great alarm was talking about this radioactive cockroach that had gotten into their house and was glowing. And the scientist then explained to the Staten Island resident that, no, it was not a radioactive cockroach. It was a firefly.
Spider-Man.
They thought it was the Freshkill landfill.
That's right.
Largest landfill in the world.
We have been warned to stay away from the Cuomo story so much, but there have been a plethora of stories that have of letters that say that the victim's sexual abuse history had been in the New York Times and in other places. So I just thought I'd mention it in the interest of fairness. That's all.
I don't understand. I'm sorry.
Oh, you don't understand? Because there was a question as to whether or not Cuomo had outed her.
It was in his defense of why it came out, right?
I'm sorry. Now I don't understand.
The paper was reporting in his defense in the statement on Sunday, which was why it was in the paper, right?
Well, according to these letters, it had been in the paper already, but I don't know. I'm just telling you we've had a huge number of letters.
I think the letter writers need to focus on what really is the heart of the matter here. A 25-year-old staff person revealed to the governor that she is a victim of sexual assault, and he continued, according to her, allegedly, to sexually harass her. I think that's what we need to stay focused on.
That ain't
who told who.
That ain't good.
David, you were starting to say?
I was going to talk about the obstructionist Republican Senate before the break, and then you just broke my heart with the fact that there's no radioactive, you know, bugs in Staten Island, and the whole Godzilla concept was that there was just a little lizard that got in, you know, to the toxic nuclear waste, and then we got Godzilla. You're telling me that Godzilla is not real now?
Don't take it all. Don't take it too seriously, David. It's just
just a little bit of time, but what I was going to say was just the fact that, you know, although it seems like this is super hyper partisan right now in Washington, D.C., there is a lot of Republican support for this bill. And that's coming from the elected officials who truly have to do something, like mayors of cities and governors of state who are Republican and are waiting on this release. And so it's not as partisan as you think.
Wait a second. What about this? What about David? What about the Senate? You're not going to get any Senate votes, and there are a lot of Republicans, 50 of them, in the Senate.
No, what I'm saying is that the Senate Republican politics is different than your state Republican and local Republican politics, because these are the people that are waiting on the relief while our senators are just playing obstruction politics.
Because
in a bubble world.
No, because of Trump.
You cannot have the Democratic president succeed.
They're scared to death of Trump. It's that simple.
Well, I think that's right, but I think David's point is really vital. There is a majority of Republicans, not by much, but support this. And I heard Teresa Bourgeois on the show yesterday making a really good point that if you talk to Republican mayors, county executives, governors, they are very supportive because they desperately need this money to balance their budgets and to fund programs. You know, talk to school superintendents, Republicans and Democrats and independents, and I bet you almost all of them support this because the schools really need the money.
I think senators are also in.
Go ahead, Dave.
David and Judith are both right. I think Republican senators know this bill is likely to pass, you know, 51-50, and they win both ways. Their districts or their states will get the funding, which they desperately need, and they can also play it off as saying, no, we voted against this. Yeah, right. They can say we opposed it to appease the hardcore Republicans.
When it passes, they'll put out press releases saying how much money they delivered to their district. Very hypocritical. Sorry, Aaron.
All right. A lot of back and forth. We love it. All right. Let's go to, we got this from Kitsy, who says, to help the plight of the pollinators, join the Pollinator Pathway Northeast. I know, David. Get ready. Please write this down. It is a movement to join vegetated areas attractive to pollinators by planting native plants in your yard. Okay.
Huh. I would do that.
Yeah. Huh. We want to help. We want to help the pollinators, as it were.
I wonder if you get a sign when you come into your town saying this is a pollinator pathway town.
That would be great. Let's see.
Really?
Well, what's wrong with that?
Nothing's wrong with it. Nothing's right with it.
It would make me want to move there.
It was a joke. Go ahead.
Judith said, Stacy says, Judith, you are right. The governor was wrong, and even more so if he continued inappropriate conversations with Ms. Bennett, if he knew she was a victim of sexual abuse and harassment. We have another roundtable question on John, who writes and says, so why exactly won't voting against direct payments of at least $2,800 to most working class families not be a complete disaster for Republicans, Aaron? Please explain the politics of this, as I do not understand. Whoever wishes to take that. Aaron, you're up, but...
Yeah, so why are Republicans opposing the $1,400 payments? Was that the gist, correct?
Yes. Why exactly won't voting against direct payments to most working class families not be a complete disaster for Republicans?
One word answer, Trump.
Republicans have little interest in governing or helping the economy. They have all of their interest is designed to get reelected and to redistribute money that could go to working families and households that are struggling to wealthy donors.
Not only that.
That's why it won't be a disaster.
Not only that, the Democrats are going to get all the credit for this. And if the Republicans have helped the Democrats, it only helps them even more. So in this Republican-Democratic world we have of ours, a 50-50 Senate, they're not going to do it. It's that simple.
Judith or David?
Anybody but Alan?
No, you.
No, I'm just kidding.
Well, I think it's important that this pass and that the Biden administration moves on to their other infrastructure proposals. This is not the only game in town. This is urgent. And this is, as some members of Congress say, this is a survival package, not a stimulus package for people who can't put food on the table. And then my understanding is late spring, early summer, we'll see a broader infrastructure package with a real emphasis on capital projects that address the climate crisis. So I'm looking forward to that as well.
In other words, that's going to be full pork and it's going to be a barbecue party.
Barbecue party. All right, we're out of time. My thanks to everybody for being with us. We welcome, we thank you for your letters. We got many of them, and for all of those that we got to, I thank you very much. My thanks to Alan, of course. Alan, thank you. Have a great weekend.
Thank you, Joe. We're going to try.
Thanks to Judith and Aaron and David. You're all great. We will be back right after this.